SCP-8976 Diagraphophobia Fragmentation. Diagraphophobia is the fear of deleting files and losing data, a relatively modern phobia compared to things like fear of the dark or snakes. Losing an important file is a fairly common occurrence across the world, and chances are it's happened to you or someone you know. While it's possible sometimes for these things to be recovered or recreated, most likely the file is gone forever, like a forgotten memory. SCP-8976 is about erased files and memories, focusing on an anomalous entity with a predilection towards devouring data, and the woman who spearheaded its investigation. Let's take a look. We're thrown right into the middle of a conversation between an L. Pearson and Maria Jones, a notable figure in the SCP universe who is mostly associated with running the Record Keeping and Information Security Administration. Pearson asks her when she first saw it, and Jones says that it was in 1982 when they were working on Sugar Bird, an algorithm to do one of the most menial items of drudge work: take in equipment requests and convert them to one standardized system before feeding them back into the relevant databases. They weren't even a real department back then, just a tiny office of a few secretaries. Pearson says that she was working on Sugar Bird in 1982 with the earliest RISA personnel, but when did she first see SCP-8976? Jones explains that she didn't see it, she saw the absence of it. A chunk of equipment order records in the J block from 1967 to 1969 by the Electrical Containment Division vanished. They were on her terminal, and she was watching when the information began to interweave with wrong equipment orders on the wrong records, impossible dates and times, and then eventually they blinked into nothing, like they'd never existed at all. Pearson says that there's a million reasons digital data can be lost, but Jones counters that it can't on a secure Foundation terminal, not with the triple redundant backups they were using, and not the way she watched it happen. It was a few meager kilobytes of data, the kind of thing no one would have noticed missing, except her, of course. It might have slipped under the radar, but it got too bold too fast, and that was a mistake. We're then given a rudimentary-looking SCP file for 8976, written up by Jones, with the object class of Keter and the containment procedures to be determined. It's described as a digital informational entity that currently exists uncontained within the SCIPNet distributed network. The particular nature and design of 8976 remain unclear pending further research, but it is an infovorous entity that consumes information from within the SCIPNet network. At the moment, Jones has no reason to believe that it is sentient. It was first encountered by her, Information Safety Administration Head Secretary Maria Jones, on July 2, 1979, in the course of the Sugar Bird Project. Seems like that date contradicts the 1982 date she told Pearson. We're then provided some excerpts from an unpublished essay written by Jones in 1976, titled The Infovore. The first excerpt reads, "Now and again, a development in the human technological record changes our species forever. Like an ant on a balloon, we cannot see the breadth of how our world is expanding. We can only feel the world shake beneath our feet and crawl for the bleeding edges. A farmer in Sumer learns to till seeds of grain. James Watts exhibits his revolutionary steam engine. The balloon is breathed into. Now we teeter on the edge of a knowledge society. The theory of information is being drawn up in front of our very eyes. How languages form and the rules and limits of what we can make these thinking engines do. Our ability to store vast libraries of information into rooms and warehouses, these little Alexandrias, offer us the same promise grain once did. I am not the only one to have this prediction. which makes me all the more confident in it. But new landscapes invite predation. Darwin's theory of evolution speaks to survival. When a niche opens in an environment, something will evolve to fill it. We live in a lush of information. The machine I write this on contains records that predate me and that will outlast me. Were something to evolve or be designed to take advantage of that, it would never go hungry. I ponder the existence of an entity, a being, a program, or an algorithm that exists off the consumption of new information, a manner of infovore. Pearson calls Jones out on the incorrect date she mentioned, which she chalks up to a typing error in the file, as she encountered 8976 in spring of 1982. Pearson comments that the file is pretty bare, and she explains that things were looser back then. You could submit something like that and follow up on it later when you had more information. She never updated the main file, though, just added an addendum when she learned something new, leading to there being over 200 addenda on the file. It started simple enough, with her just wanting to observe the anomaly's behavior a bit more, to figure out exactly what it was. She began by inserting some small amount of junk data into the memory block that was previously attacked by the InfoVore, but there was no reaction. Next, she tried inserting the same data that had previously been in the memory block, but there was still no reaction. After that, she tried putting in some non-junk data, consisting of new equipment records. After 3 minutes and 13 seconds, data corruption began, and 46 seconds later, the data was permanently gone. We're then given another excerpt from her essay, which reads, "Were it to exist, the InfoVore would be a consumptive algorithm. There are no limits placed on it, because why would it limit itself? It consumes information, eating knowledge and noticed only by its absence, a trail of not breadcrumbs it leaves behind after gorging itself. In this way, it is not so different from a human, as we too seek to learn. But unlike us, it does not leave the information behind for future generations to learn from, because it cannot remember. It must be simple to be an efficient consumer, and this precludes complex memory structures. Were it to have a complex memory, it would scale linearly in size and complexity with what it ate, meaning it would grow slower and slower as it worked to determine if it has tasted this particular information before or not. It can simply destroy the information after tasting it, thus guaranteeing it will never return to it again. One must respect the almost perverse simplicity of the InfoVore. The information it eats is never remembered, and so it never remembers it has eaten, and so it is always hungry. The applications of an InfoVore are numerous. Even conservative predictions argue that by the year 2000, most financial institutions will retain primarily electric records. The risk will become so thoroughly manageable. States and society at large soon follow. Were one to engineer an InfoVore to devour only portions of such data, it could rampage through a memory set for quite some time before its wormholes were noticed. Pearson remarks that she went through 2 iterations of nothing happening and she didn't conclude that she just misremembered what happened, to which Jones simply replies that she doesn't make mistakes. The 2 variables she had were the content of the data and the placement in memory, and since content was easier to manipulate, she first tried putting in nonsense. Then she copied the data that had been erased and replaced it, as maybe something about those particular records were the problem and attracted it somehow. Pearson asks where she copied it from, as it was erased. She replies that it wasn't erased from her head, though, calling it a steel trap. That didn't work either, though, so she tried new data, which then attracted the InfoVore. She repeated it 2 more times with more new data. I'll note that this paragraph from Jones is covered in the document by a large black box with the text, "Memory Damaged." Pearson asks if she showed it to the rest of the ISA personnel, and she says that she certainly tried. With two others present, she tried putting in new data consisting of equipment records into the same memory block, but there wasn't any reaction from the InfoVore. She then tried putting in the same data into a new memory block, but there still wasn't any reaction. We're given another excerpt from the essay, which reads, "The InfoVore is defined by consumption. It is engineered, whether by designer or by nature, to seek out significant and unfamiliar information. This puts it inexorably at odds with humans. We do not seek out significant and unfamiliar information. All information is unfamiliar to us until we have consumed it, and only then do we determine if it is significant or not. In essence, we build a model in our memory arranged by what is significant, our employee code, and what is familiar, the location of our house keys, and what is both, our memories of our wedding night." In summary, the human mind presents an ideal model of the kind of memory set an InfoVore would be easiest to predate on. Thus, we see the risks both of modeling computerized memory in the image of human memory and of arranging human memory as computerized data. The InfoVore seeks significant and familiar information because this allows it to destroy all recurrences of that information and make its future searches more efficient. If it were to prey on a mind, the mind would not realize it was being preyed on, as human memory is prone to fault and self-doubt in a way electronic memory is not. The relationship becomes closer to that of a parasite, insect with a proboscis burrowed into the medulla as it sucks away. Jones says that the InfoVore was taunting her, not engaging when she had other witnesses around to prove its existence. Pearson counters that sentience seems like an extreme conclusion to jump to, and Jones doesn't disagree, but it was just her instinctive gut reaction. She tentatively confirmed it with a few more experiments. This was an oddity, a strange little quirk in the database that she noticed. SCIPnet didn't even exist in the form it does today back then. It was largely just a packet network for sites to exchange research papers. She had more pressing work to do for the ISA, so it got left by the wayside. She's not a researcher, so it was sort of a pet project for her, as it was nagging at her. If it was eating data wholesale, she didn't like the idea of not knowing what she didn't know. So she decided to focus to try and figure out what it was targeting and see if she could build a pattern. In another experiment, she inserted a larger chunk of data into a memory block, consisting of equipment orders, shift logs, and payroll receipts from 1970 to 1980. Data corruption began 2 minutes and 10 seconds in, although large portions of the memory were left untouched. Next, she inserted a larger chunk of data consisting of selected work history summaries from her own personnel file, with the data being fully consumed and erased. Later, she uploaded 23 megabytes of her personal photos, all of which were consumed and erased. We're given another excerpt from the essay, which reads, "In the late stages of an InfoVore infection, the memory set, whether biological or electronic, is more whole than flesh. However, it continues to trudge on, unaware it has been emptied of all purpose, as a memory set exists to hold memory. Once said memory has been destroyed, the set approaches the empty set and becomes purposeless. Always found computers to be superior to humans in this regard, as once an electronic memory set has been emptied, it can be refilled with new data. When a biological memory set has been emptied, there is no refilling it with new data. A human can only live one life. Brain desperately grasps at what data it can ascertain the integrity of, often random bytes in a sea of garbled corruption. No prediction of what it will land on." Pearson asks if this Infovore was targeting her, and Jones says that it wasn't targeting her specifically. She repeated it with data and records from two security personnel who had died a few years prior, and it ate them just as happily. It had changed and gotten bored with equipment orders not being interesting anymore. It concerned her, and concerned Pearson too, when she told her. Pearson asks what she had said in response about it, saying that her memory is a little foggy. Jones recalls that she pointed out that nobody cared about the junk data or receipts and work orders from a decade ago, but Jones had cared about her photos and writings. Pearson remarks that she destroyed them awfully eagerly, but Jones again compares her mind to a steel trap, saying that she redid the writings on a typewriter, as she wasn't taking any chances. As for the photographs, her response is corrupted from the record, but she smiles briefly and says that it was an unfortunate loss, but well worth it. Pearson asks what her conclusion was, and Jones says that we aren't computers, and we don't arrange our memories in a strict order. It's a jumble of experiences, sights, sounds, and sensations approximately spread out by recency and how important they are to us. 8976 feasts like a blind mole, digging through the dirt and devouring it with no idea what it'll find ahead. It has no way of searching for the morsels it wants, things that are important and matter. Memories we hold close, the kind that stay in your head from when you're a kid and don't let go until the day you die. It wants information that matters to someone. Jones then asks what time it is, saying that she has a meeting. Pearson tells her that she doesn't, as they canceled it, asking her if she remembers. Jones replies that she would rather she didn't do that without speaking to her first, and Pearson's response is corrupted from the record. Sometime after testing her personal photos on the Infovore, there was an unplanned incident with it deleting data regarding a sensitive addenda for another SCP. Jones intervened in the investigation and detected classic signs of 8976 activity. Later, she tested the Infovore again by uploading data consisting of state problem analyses written by her from 1979 to 1987. Data corruption began a minute in, but then ceased after 12 seconds, with her stating that it got bored. Another unplanned incident happened later with another SCP, deleting the entire file and all supporting documents. She detected classic signs of 8976 activity, stating that it was getting hungrier. We're given another excerpt of her essay, which reads, "Humans are superior in this, as they show concern for one another. One notices another has forgotten something. They worry and try to remind the other. We can be reminded and fill in gaps in our memory, another advantage. Though, of course, the folly is that others are, too, flawed sets and may attempt to convince you of faulty memories. They do their best, though. Memories are more than a type of data, though. They represent a collection of many types of data. Sensory data, for one. The taste of an orange in Sacramento and the sound of a Ray Charles record, two wholly separate inputs that are inextricably intertwined with each other and with feeling the cool water of the creek on my feet and the red-hot indignity of a rock throne. They are complex and overlapping, and so make it very difficult to know when just one piece of the puzzle is faulty." Pearson comments that these logs were just as ISA was turned into RISA, so she must have been busy. Jones replies that she was, kind of like she is now, except for not having uppity RISA officers to bother and distract her. Pearson apologizes for taking up her precious time, but it is a required review. Jones angrily replies that she knows damn well it's required, stating that she was in her seat before Pearson was wearing diapers. Pearson remarks that Jones helped her get into the seat, and Jones asks how so. Pearson's response is corrupted from the record, but Jones says that she's fairly certain they've never met before. Pearson's response to that is also corrupted, and Jones snorts, saying that she's not the first person to tell her that. Pearson moves on, calling the log troubling, and asking if this InfoVor could read, write, modify, and delete SCP files across the whole database. Jones says that it couldn't at first, but it grew, growing more powerful and hungrier to match. She now believes that it's sentient, but this was when the Ryza restructuring was occurring, so she didn't have time or energy to waste on a small, persistent server bug. Pearson's response is corrupted, and Jones says that she was trying to build a department, an organism to survive her. She didn't really sit down and analyze the results until she returned, which was an error in retrospect. Maybe things would have gone differently if she had rushed and looked at her data before going to go meet with the council. She can't help but wonder, as maybe this thing would have been stomped out early, and maybe Elise would have survived. Pearson's reply is corrupted, and she then says that Jones mentioned an Elise, but she doesn't see an Elise in any of these documents. Jones says that she's in there, but then touches her temple lightly and says that she got a little confused. Pearson asks if she wants to take a short break, but Jones wants to get this over with. She says that the InfoVor was getting bolder, venturing into the database when it wasn't being fed anymore. It had been a nice little pet project to keep an eye on while she was a secretary, but she's the director of a major department. SCIPnet wasn't getting any less useful anytime soon, so it had to go. The next excerpt of her essay reads, "I retire soon. I have served dutifully at this organization and built Ryza into an entity I am proud of. I sometimes return to this essay and to that file. Never for long. This is a confused, meandering item of writing that is better left in this file drawer. I write this addendum largely for you, Leslie, because I know you will be searching through my drawers after I depart for Montana with Rufus. I remember sitting and writing this as a young woman between ISA shifts. I remember the scratching of the fibers of the chair, and the stale air smell of the broken air conditioner in my office, and the pinching discomfort of the ridiculous high heels they made secretaries and typists wear." Her experiment log also continues, with one entry involving her loading data into a physically gapped server, then placed into a Faraday cage with an internal power source. The data consisted of 78 megabytes of assorted testing data on miscellaneous SCPs, classified as high importance, and data corruption began 2 minutes and 10 seconds in. 5 minutes later, the data was fully consumed and erased, with her noting that she only managed to slow it down. Another experiment involved the clean wipe of the SCIPnet network and servers, with all sensitive data being backed onto persistent physical memory. Core services were inspected for anomalous code or modifications before being returned to service one by one over the course of 2 weeks. The test was performed before the data reload, onto an empty network, with the data consisting of her own personnel dossier and security file. The data corruption began 55 seconds in, and a minute later, it was fully consumed and erased, with her noting that it should not have been possible. Another experiment, with this one numbering 101, is a bit jumbled. She writes that she deliberately reduced power to the SCIPnet systems, but then writes that she's back in Sacramento, throwing rocks across the creek. She's bundled up and waiting for the train to Cambridge. Plaid dresses and painful heels in the lecture halls at MIT. The white professors not bothering to hide their equal parts disgust and desire, knowing she can't say a thing. Writing to Daddy back home so he knows that he can go over to the Clarice's for Christmas if she's not back. She's there. Again. Pearson comments that it survived all that, and Jones says that she had no idea how deep it had wormed itself in. It was wriggling among the circuit boards and the silicon, and it wasn't just parasitizing SCIPNet, it had become a part of it. Pearson's reply is corrupted, and Jones says that it's not her fault no one else is looking. People make mistakes, and they see something missing and assume they remembered wrong. That's not the way she is, and it's not the way she's ever been. Even when she was a little girl, she didn't remember things wrong. Her sister would forget where she left her dolls or leave the washing outside overnight, but not her. Pearson's response is again corrupted, but Jones says to look how well she turned out, prompting Pearson to ask if she remembers. Jones asks what she just said, and Pearson apologizes, telling her to continue. Jones says that those are just two out of about 36 different strategies they tried to force it out. Pearson's response is again corrupted, and Jones says that she clearly inherited her father's brains. They didn't succeed, and it didn't help that she was the only one who knew what they were looking for. The council didn't like her spending money on something they weren't sure existed, and if they had their way, the file would have been canned. It wasn't, because everyone at RISA knows better than to second-guess her judgment. The experiment log continues, although the written text is now quite informal, with shorthand used for various words and a lack of capitalization. She writes that Project Woodpecker is online, with a live, updated, redundant backup of SCIPNet database and 4 RISA technicians on call to ensure the veracity of data. If there's an unexpected deletion of data, 2 or more technicians are to manually confirm data validity before authorizing a re-upload back to the central SCIPNet database. The first 8976 incident resulted in the data being simultaneously deleted from Woodpecker backups, so the project was shuttered in failure. Later, Jones, alongside Elise Jones, performed another experiment, modifying SCIPNet to not allow write modifications without the transmission of a uniquely generated approval code from a secondary RISA authority. The code is requested on every write action and requires verification of user identity and intention before generation and transmission. The first 8976 incident resulted in totally bypassing the verification mechanism, modifying memory directly on hardware, resulting in short-circuited registers and an expensive replacement of boards. The incident recurred after replacement until the SCIPNet update was rolled back. The next entry of the essay is largely just a random assortment of words and sentence fragments, with various mentions of Montana, Elise, Cambridge, lectures, Christmas, Sacramento, MIT, wedding, and so on. In the present, Jones says that she's tired and needs water, but Pearson's response is corrupted, and her name is no longer listed, instead just reading as unknown. Jones asks what they were talking about, and Pearson mentions the file. Jones says that this seems familiar, asking if she wrote this. Pearson replies that she hopes so, as she's the only person who's ever added to the 8976 file, by the look of it. Jones says that people didn't really bother reading it, but she still did her best to document everything cleanly and meticulously. Pearson comments on this being clean and meticulous, and Jones replies that she doesn't appreciate the sass. Pearson apologizes, but says that she can't make sense of a lot of it. Jones explains that by that point, RISA was a proper organism, and instead of them just sitting in closets, they had a dedicated site. They had resources to leverage, and she tried to leverage them to slow down 8976, unsuccessfully. Like throwing rocks at it and hoping it bleeds. Pearson's response is corrupted, and Jones says that it didn't stop, and it's ongoing. They can't just roll over for this thing. Pearson's response is again missing, and Jones says that she just told her she's still doing this. The director has certain responsibilities, and she does not enjoy repeating herself. Experiment 151 involved her uploading a package of sensitive RISA data to the database, along with a package of personal photos, writings, recollections, and project plans. The corruption of the second package began 5 minutes in, and 5 minutes later, it was fully consumed and erased. Package one was left untouched, and she notes that it's greedy and wants her. She writes that that's good, and it can have her. In the present now, all of Pearson's statements have been corrupted, so we only have Jones's side of the conversation. She says that that's the last thing in the file, and asks if they're done here. She then asks why the council is involved with this, and says that her files don't need auditing. She corrects Pearson to say Director Jones, but then calls her ridiculous, stating that she didn't retire, she built this place. Jones then starts to stutter, telling her to stop, saying that that's not true. She says that it's 1996, and then says that this isn't her office, asking where she is. She starts to hyperventilate, asking where the hell she is and who Pearson is. She starts screaming for her to tell her who she is, and asks where Leslie is. She yells at her to get away from her, and the remainder of the conversation becomes corrupted. We're then given the last of the essay, which reads, "I am a child again. I am at the patch of dry, untillable, dead and sun-scorched land outside Sacramento that my father bled on until orange trees sprouted. I remember stealing one away with Elsie and going barefoot to the creek when we knew the white boys would be at church. I remember realizing I was wrong, that I had forgotten there would be no church this week because their pastor was ill. My face going hot as they threw rocks at us from the other side of the water, and Elise's head bled. I remember sobbing into my mother's dress. I remember my mother. I am my mother, watching a little black girl cry. I remember my father falling asleep in his rocking chair by the door with a shotgun. I remember being utterly alone in my classes. What few white girls were in the sciences refusing to share any notes with me. I remember seeing Rufus Pearson at the dance and asking him whether he smoked. I remember our wedding. I remember Elise's head bleeding. I remember a boy at a dance offering me a cigarette and lighting it for me, gray smoke swirling up into the air. I remember a girl's head on the bank of a creek, red dissolving into cool blue. I don't know their names. I love them. I remember everything. I remember nothing at all. Let it eat me alive." An addendum states that following careful analysis by RISA officers, the council has voted to archive the 8976 file for two reasons. One is that the anomalous nature of the object is unsubstantiated and/or inadequately confirmed, as it was never witnessed by any member of Foundation personnel other than former RISA director Maria Jones, who has repeatedly protected the file from standard archival votes. Two is that Jones is no longer available to the Foundation, having taken a medical retirement, and is thus unavailable for further contact or research on the anomaly. The last part of the document is another dialogue section, in which Pearson climbs the porch steps of the lake house at dusk, ringing the doorbell but receiving no response. She raps her knuckles against the door, which swings open freely on squeaky hinges. Somewhere a bird is startled by the noise. She calls out to her mom, but there's no response, and so she steps over the threshold. Her fingers grope the wall until they wrap around a light switch, but nothing happens when she flicks it. She turns on the flashlight on her phone, showing almost every visible surface to be papered over with post-it notes, sticky notes, and white notebook paper scotch-taped to the wall. They cover the walls of the foyer entirely. A table next to the door holds a bowl containing a jumble of caramel candies and loose keys, and the floor contains scattered rags, socks, and other garments. Pearson progresses through the foyer, calling out again to her mom, but there's still no response. She proceeds into what might have been the kitchen, but is now a tight, narrow corridor made of file boxes, stacked to nearly the ceiling and visibly bulging with papers. She has to turn to the side to squeeze through. The boxes are labeled in trembling Sharpie handwriting with months and years, and they don't appear to be in any particular order. She says that she doesn't want to alarm Dr. Jones, but she came by to let her know that they decided to review some old files, and 8976 got archived. She squeezes out of the crevice, into the living room, which is illuminated by the harsh color bars of the television left on. Pink and red and blue and green light washes out over endless file boxes, VHS tapes, CDs, DVDs, tape recorders, notepads, microfilm, and stacks of newspapers. There is a sofa and a coffee table in front of the TV, but only the tops of either are visible over the sea of media that rises mid-calf. The walls are packed with teetering stacks of VHS tapes and cassettes, crammed together in obsessively labeled stacks. The TV is connected to DVD and VHS players, a microfilm viewer, and a half dozen other obsolete accessories. The cassette player is ticking, a tape not quite inserted into it. Pearson reaches forward, pushing it in. The cassette player accepts it, ticking for a second before the screen shifts. It's some kind of home video that has been recorded over and over again, with the immense degradation making it impossible to determine what the video originally was. There are frames of a man and a woman at the altar in wedding garments, a shot of an open lake taken from a kayak, a few seconds of an Elvis Presley performance, followed by news reports from the Rwandan genocide. Two young black girls in matching dresses waving at the camera. United Airlines Flight 175 crashing into the South Tower. The Soviet Red Army liberating Auschwitz. A man in a sterile hospital gown holding a baby. The fall of the Berlin Wall. A woman standing in front of a building, beaming and holding a briefcase. An old couple wearing N95 masks waving at the camera. Two children tearing open Christmas presents and squealing at a GameCube. Israeli soldiers firing into a crowd of protesters. A car driving away, rattling cans tied to the bumper. A woman crying at a funeral. A burning cross staked into a lawn, surrounded by men in white hoods. A couple kissing in front of the lake house. On and on, images growing more and more corrupted until they wither away into nothing but gray static. The tape ejects, sliding forward and falling into the sea of thousands on the floor. Pearson turns and snatches a post-it at random off the wall, seeing that it's blank. Looking around, all of them are blank, and in the sudden silence, a strange, soft, scratching sound is audible. She begins to panic, stating that it's here, and calls out again to her mom. She turns on her heel before seeing a flickering, faint light coming from the far hall. She wades through the sea of media on the floor towards it as the scratching grows louder. She rounds the corner, facing into a bedroom. The jumble of media on the floor continues into the room, where an elderly Maria Jones is lying on an armchair, her head leaned back. A phonograph in the corner of the room spins away at an old record that has long since been worn smooth. There is no music anymore, just a dull scratching. Pearson softly asks her how long it's been, and Jones stirs slightly, asking who's there. Pearson says that it's her, it's Leslie, and she steps forward, raising her light. Jones leans forward into the light, showing the left hemisphere of her skull having been caved in, leaving a gaping, bloody wound. The pink gray of her brain is visible through the hole, blood congealing all over her face. She squints into the light, asking if it's Elise, and a figure shifts in the darkness behind her. Leslie screams. The document ends with a fatal memory error. Alright, so obviously the article is about dementia and the slow, horrific deterioration that can happen to a human mind, even one as strong and as reliable as Maria Jones. Throughout the article, she's interviewed by her own daughter, but seems to not recognize her at all, and only deteriorates further from there. We're led to believe that the anomaly she was investigating didn't exist at all, as no one else had witnessed it, the council didn't believe it existed, and not even her own daughter believed it. In the end, though, it seems pretty clear that the anomaly does exist, and has been specifically feeding on Jones for decades. She had suspected that the anomaly was sentient, and it looks like it did a very clever job of hiding itself, with everyone else just writing it off as escalating signs of Jones' dementia. Having grown stronger and stronger over the preceding decades, it now seems powerful enough to just consume people's minds entirely. Of course, the article isn't really about the anomaly, and it wouldn't have changed a whole lot if the anomaly hadn't been real. To the average person, it doesn't really matter if their loved one's mind is being eaten by an invisible infovore, or if it's just breaking down from a mundane, albeit horrific, condition. Either way, it's tragic and heartbreaking, as there's very little that can be done, and the person becomes a shell of their former self. Losing your memories and your own identity, being unable to recognize people you've known for years, is certainly a great fear. And as usual, fictional monsters can hardly compare to our own fragility.